This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. When a new president was inaugurated in Liberia 3 years ago, the ceremony was attended by First Lady Laura Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. That's because Liberia's new leader, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is the first woman ever elected an African head of state, and because her election represents new hope for peace in the West African nation after years of civil war and economic devastation. Hundreds of thousands died in the factional strife that gripped Liberia for more than a dozen years. Much of the chaos is blamed on Charles Taylor, the former warlord known for drug-addicted child soldiers and gruesome atrocities. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a Harvard-educated economist who spent much of her life in the United States working for private banks, the World Bank, and the United Nations. But she spent enough time in Liberia and criticized its governments often enough to land in prison more than once. She beat a crowded field of candidates to win the presidency of Liberia in 2005. She's written a new memoir called This Child Will Be Great. Well, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, welcome to Fresh Air. When you were inaugurated as president in early 2006, the country had had many, many years of war. Describe the condition of the country as you found it.
We inherited a devastated country. After what you might call 2 decades of economic freefall, 14 years of civil conflict that resulted in the death of 250,000 people, with 1 million additional people displaced, many of whom resided in refugee camps in neighboring countries and other countries abroad, infrastructure ruined, all institutions dysfunctional, civil servants, army, haven't been paid for years, foreign missions. In fact, under sanctions by the UN for the misuse of resources to fuel the war, a people with hopelessness, a people destitute, a people impoverished as a result of all of this. We were classified as a failed state. Nothing was working. Lights, water, basic infrastructure, basic services to the people just did not exist.
No electricity in the capital of Monrovia, right? Did dark after nightfall unless you had a private generator?
And that's correct. Mm-hmm. The capital city and the rest of the country was dark, except, as you say, those who had private generators. And so it was really a sad situation and something that, the needs were so vast, the things to be addressed so enormous. Where do we start?
You know, Liberia has a unique history in Africa, you know, established in 1847 by freed slaves from the United States. And, you know, over the years, its population nourished by emigres from the United States. And you write in your book how there grew up this interesting social division within the country of a settler class, people from the States, who tended to be the social and political elite called Congo people at times. Tell us about your own ethnic background in this context.
Well, let me say that I don't form part of what is called the settler groups or the Americo-Liberians or the Congos, as they are called. My background is essentially indigenous, although there's one-fourth part of me that comes from a German background, as my maternal grandfather was a German trader in one of our rural counties who took a native wife. But the rest of me and the rest of my family basically come from those who represent what was called a native population. However, let me quickly say that there was a system in our country that persists even today where poor families living in rural areas gave their children to families of the settlers to enable them to get an education. And both of my parents benefited from that. My father, who was the son of a Gola chief, you know, was given to one family. My mother was given to another family. So they were educated, and in a way they became over time part of the elite class.
You have this fascinating course of your life where you spent a lot of time in the United States and in other countries working for private banks, for the World Bank, for the United Nations, and then at various times were in Liberia, either working in the government or criticizing the government and getting into trouble for it. And you were imprisoned several times, and I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit about one of them. And this was the time in 1985 when the then President Samuel Doe, I guess there had been a coup attempt, and he had, in reaction, had come down hard on all of his internal critics. How were you arrested?
Well, at the time when the coup failed and the announcement came that President Doe was back in charge, all of us who had sort of been on the streets swiftly went back into our homes. I was in my mother's house when a group of soldiers came and surrounded the house and, you know, and were shooting into the air. I feared that they would enter the house and perhaps shoot and my mother could get killed. So I simply went outside and said, you're looking for me. And they knew they were looking for me and said, yes, and come with us. And that's, I hope, saved my mother. And so I got into the jeep with them. And they wanted me to take them to one of our other party leaders. I knew if I had done that, and they had taken the both of us to the executive mansion where President Doe was, something bad could have happened. So I said I didn't know where he was and pointed them into the other direction. We went, and as we were going, another group of soldiers came in another jeep, and they said I was their rightful prisoner because they came from the military barracks where I was to be taken and jailed. And so I got into their jeep, and along the way, you know, they were taunting and acts of terror, you know, taking a match and striking it and close to my hair and say, we're going to burn your hair off. And so I would plead with them and say, you know, would you, what if somebody were doing this to your mother, you know, or your sister? And I think I got to their conscience, and we went, and there was, as we drove along, at one point they went off the road and to a place where they said that was the place I was to be buried alive. And again, I went into the same stance of saying, you can't do this, you know, just think again of your mother. And once again, they turned around and said, okay, we won't kill you today, we'll kill you tomorrow.
And where were you taken?
I was taken to the barracks. It was called the Shuffling Military Barracks. The barracks are still there today, as a matter of fact. Those barracks are where our new army is now being trained with U.S. support, a brand new army. The little two-room shed where they took me is still there today, although it's been improved, but I take people there from time to time so they can see where I went into prison. In any case, I was taken there, and there were about a dozen men in the jail cell that was there. They put me in the cell with them. And with, you know, taunting me and taunting them and calling them rebels and calling me rebel too. And they took the men out, left me alone in a cell. There was some shooting in the background sometime later. The men never came back. And I remained in that cell and went through some very, very difficult experience.
This wasn't the first time you were arrested, but I believe you said this is the one time that you really feared for your life. What was different about this one?
Well, here I was going to in a military camp, you know, all by myself in a cell surrounded by soldiers, many of whom, you know, were on drink and drugs. And it's coming after the end of a coup attempt against their leader, their commander-in-chief. And I'm taking as one of those, you know, who being accused of being part of the rebellion, you know, just getting into the prison cell, I think, was itself a major achievement. And it was the one time when I knew where I was, anything could have happened because things happen to others. And why I escaped, like I say, maybe prayers, God, luck.
Eventually you were released and made your way out of the country, back to the States, where you really could have had a comfortable life. I mean, you had an established professional background in finance and international economic matters. Did you ever think maybe you would just say goodbye to Liberia and live inside the Beltway in Washington as a, you know, as a well-regarded African expert?
No, I've always felt that I was part of the processes of change. I represented, like many others, an agent of change. And I wasn't about to run away from it. So even though circumstances dictated from time to time that I leave the scene, go into exile or go into a professional life, I always knew within myself that I was going to go back.
You know, in 1989, you were living abroad, that is to say, not in Liberia. Samuel Doe was the president, and his regime was characterized by corruption and the suppression of all internal opposition. And then a rebel military leader arises in the countryside, leading rebel forces opposed to him by this man, Charles Taylor. Did you know who he was at the time? Tell us about Charles Taylor.
Well, I knew who he was because he was a part of the Liberian student movement, Liberian leaders here in the United States that had also challenged the Talbot administration, of which I was a part, had also demonstrated in times when President Talbot and his delegation, which I was a part, came to the United Nations. So, and he was one of those in the student leadership here that was invited to Liberia to come and discuss and dialogue with what was going on in the country to face what may have been considered the realities that that they were unaware of. And so I knew him in that sense. That was the first time I met him, when he returned to Liberia with that leadership group. That was sometime in 1979. He then was in the country when the coup took place in April 1980, and he was appointed a member of the new government in charge of public general services. And I must say, at that time, I was in exile here, and there are many of us, given what was going on with the Doe administration and the repression and our own inability to move it toward to more democracy and free elections. So many of the things that Mr. Taylor and his people represented were endorsed and supported by many of us, even though we were not part of their group as such. But all the right things were being said about change. But the whole thing ended up getting very ugly because it was very clear several months after the invasion of the country that there was no intent on the part of Mr. Taylor to be a part of change, but it was just a quest for power. And the nation has paid the price for that.
Early on, in July of 1990, you made it clear that you would not be able to support Charles Taylor and his rebel movement. But, of course, fighting escalated in the country and went on for many, many years. Tell our listeners what made Charles Taylor's methods and role unique. What was the impact he had on Liberia?
Oh, it was a very, very major impact because it was very clear that the main motive of Mr. Taylor was to take power, and anybody who he felt stood in the way of that would be eliminated. And people close to us were, you know, head of our political party, Jackson Doe, who had won the 1985 elections according to our results, and whom we thought would be protected, was in fact killed. The same applied to so many who Mr. Taylor may have felt was a threat to him. And so once he took power, it was clear that the singular objective was to amass wealth. And he also, you know, he also had a territorial ambition. It seemed like that's why the war went into Sierra Leone, that he wanted to own the resources not only of Liberia, but the resources of the sub-region, and was willing to advocate and promote rebellion anywhere that would give him that kind of power. So our own country was devastated. People were impoverished. Institutions became dysfunctional. I mean, dictatorship. I mean, he was a clear dictator with no conscience. Many people died.
And what about his use of children in war?
Well, that's very known again in all the reports that have been made. I mean, young children were turned into killers. They were put on drugs. They were put on drink, and you know, they were taught to kill the what they call the small boys brigade. And these young children depriving the education today. We have young people in our society, 20 years old, teenagers, who've never been to school, never had the opportunity, because they were fighting and because most people left the country into refugee camps or displaced. The schools all closed down. And so, I mean, it has taken a whole generation away from us and you know, and made the rebuilding of our strongholds so difficult in just the 10 years or 12 years or so that Mr. Taylor ruled.
And of course, he intervened in the civil war in neighboring Sierra Leone, backed a group there that was known for hacking the limbs off of their opponents. I wonder, as you looked at this country, which, you know, before 1980 had not seen this kind of violence, and you saw so many factions engaged in this brutality, I wonder, what did you make of that kind of savagery taking over the country that you had known for so long? How did you explain it?
I can't explain it. It's a savagery to which I'm not accustomed, not many Liberians. What took place outside of Liberia is very sad. Till today, it pains us.
Charles Taylor was eventually driven from power. The other West African nations intervened, and there were a series of peace initiatives. And then in 2005, elections were held, and you emerged victorious. So you arrive in 2006 and have to unite a country which has been fractionalized for so long. And you had a real issue on your hands in bringing some peace and reconciliation to a country that had been torn by armed factions for so long. Charles Taylor, I mean, the despot who had ruled the country and inflicted such misery, was, I believe, in asylum in Nigeria. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us what you decided to do about those who demanded that Charles Taylor be brought to account for his crimes, and then the issue in general of people wanting retribution for atrocities which had been committed in the years of war.
Well, let's put it this way. Charles Taylor was indicted not by a court in Liberia, but by a United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone. And that court had been wanting to make sure that that indictment was carried out and that Mr. Taylor would face trial for that. So the fact that he was in asylum in Nigeria, and Nigeria had said that they would keep him there until there was a new government. But at the same time, we were very clear that we had to respect the decision of the United Nations. And so we worked with Nigeria to make sure that that their own condition were met, but at the same time, the international condition were met.
So he's now on trial in the International Court in The Hague, is that right?
That's correct. He was taken from the Sierra Leone court to The Hague.
I wanted to ask one question about the country and its connection to its history. You know, other African countries fought against colonialism or apartheid, and that in some ways kind of defined their national character. Liberia didn't. I mean, it was independent since the 1840s. And I wonder how you think that may have affected Liberia's development and Liberian sense of their national character.
It's something that we're grappling with, and I try to deal with it in the book by saying that because we never had this common cause that bind us, because we lacked a national identity, you know, the fusion between the settler class and the indigenous class, the failure to get the assimilation that would have made the nation one, and that our own experience has maybe undermined our ability to have moved ahead as a unified people with a common cause. And I think that's still it's an issue that we have to deal with today. Who are we? We are Africans, there's no doubt. We're part of the African scene. But our history is still so tied to our relationship with America, and much of our values, tradition, have been transmuted by those who, you know, who return. We're finding a way to bring all of this together in a way that helps our nation not only to find itself, but to reach its potential and to make all of its people know who they are.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, I want to wish you the best of luck in continuing to bring peace and development to Liberia. And thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is the president of Liberia. Her new memoir is called This Child Will Be Great. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. As Major League Baseball gets underway this week, roughly one out of every eight players on the field are from the Dominican Republic. The Caribbean nation has become such a fertile breeding ground for baseball talent that every Major League team now has a baseball academy there, and thousands of Dominican teenagers dream of being signed to an American team's farm system and eventually making it to the States. The Dominican baseball world is the setting for the latest film by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. The young filmmaking team who wrote and directed Half Nelson, a widely acclaimed independent film starring Ryan Gosling as a Brooklyn school teacher. Their new film is called Sugar. It's a baseball story, but also an immigrant tale and a coming-of-age drama, centered on an aspiring young pitcher named Miguel Santos. In this scene from Sugar, Santos and other players at a baseball academy are practicing some English phrases they'll need if their talent takes them to the United States.
I got it. Fly ball.
Fly ball.
Line drive. Ground ball.
Ground ball.
Ground ball.
Ground ball.
Home run.
Home run.
Home run.
Home run.
Home run.
I asked Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck how they got to know the world of Dominican baseball and its American academies.
We actually, you know, to take a step back, we live in New York, and we started our research journey in the Bronx, where there's a very large Dominican population. And we went up to this field, Roberto Clemente Ballpark, in Crotona Park in the Bronx. And we met, there's a league where players play on weekends, and we met a lot of the guys that had been through a very similar journey to Miguel, who's featured in the movie. And we just heard their stories, and they introduced us to other players, and they gave us contacts in the Dominican Republic. And we kind of worked our way backwards from there, and we kind of said, oh, we know the end of our movie. This is the end of the journey. Now let's go figure out where the story begins and how they get here. So that led us to the Dominican Republic, where we would go to these academies. We would get there really early and eat breakfast with these guys, go watch them train until about noon. They'd play a game, and then they'd go eat lunch. They'd have their English lesson. Then they'd watch American horror films until lights out.
And I guess what's fascinating about this, and we see some of this in the film, is that you have a kid who's 16, many of them from poor backgrounds, who suddenly has, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 in American money, may never set foot in even a minor league park in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
suddenly, at this tender age, is the big breadwinner in the family and the embodiment of a family's hopes and dreams. And that must really change their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are so many of these guys who start, you know, building houses for their parents so that everybody can live a little bit more comfortably. A lot of these constructions are never finished because you have money to start them, and then things don't pan out quite the way that these guys expected them to, and the constructions are abandoned. And you'll see that all over the Dominican Republic when you drive around, these houses that are half built.
I want to talk about Miguel's journey to the States, but first I wanted to ask you about finding the actor. I mean, now, the guy who plays Miguel, whose name is Angeles Perez Soto, was not an actor, right? He was a ball player. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's true. Algenis, when we met him, basically when we were casting the movie, we would drive around the Dominican Republic in a van, and we had a guide who would take us to different fields, and we'd break out a video camera and invite kids to interview with us. And anybody who had a spark or any kind of charisma or could tell a story or a joke and feel comfortable with us, we'd invite back and to read a scene from the movie. And that's how we found Al Hennis. And he was number 452 of about 600 people we interviewed that way. And we were really excited to meet him when we did, because we weren't sure we were going to find anybody up until that point.
You know, it struck me as interesting that you have this whole structure of Major League Baseball, which is down in the Dominican Republic, constantly finding talent, recruiting talent, promoting some of it, leaving others behind. And here you're filmmakers also coming from the United States, bringing, you know, some money and opportunity to people. Did you feel in any way that you were sort of recreating that kind of world of engaging and developing talent, maybe raising hopes but sometimes not fulfilling them?
You know, because if we were coming down there and offering a baseball scholarship on these baseball fields, you know, I think that would be one thing. But there's no acting community in the Dominican Republic, and we looked for it, believe me. So I think when we came down there saying, you know, we're going to make a movie, nobody had ever had a dream or aspiration to act in a movie before. And I think they were very confused, most of the people we'd met, about what we were up to. And even Al Hennis, once we met him and we had him come to multiple callbacks and we put him through this process, we offered him the part, and he didn't show much enthusiasm because he didn't really believe that he was going to be in a movie. You know, that's just some made-up Hollywood thing. It's much more attainable for these guys to become superstar baseball players in their heads than it ever was to act in a movie.
If you're just joining us, our guests are filmmakers Anna Bowden and Ryan Fleck. They made the film Half Nelson, the new film which they wrote and directed about Dominican baseball and a ballplayer's journey to America, is called Sugar. Well, the character in your film, Miguel, is finally selected to come to invited to spring training in the United States, which is the dream of these guys who are in these Dominican players who are in these academies run by big league teams in the Dominican Republic. And there's a big party before he leaves and discovers there that there are friends and relatives who approach him that he can't even remember. Was this a common experience?
Yeah, we heard a lot of stories about that. You know, as soon as you start to have some success, people come out of the woodwork. And it was really interesting because we watched this movie in the Dominican Republic with the Dominican audience to open the Dominican Republic Film Festival back in November. And at that moment in the film, there was so much laughter in the theater. I mean, it was like you couldn't even hear what was being said. And we've watched it many times with American audiences, and you'll get like a few chuckles here and there. But I don't think that it's as visceral for American audiences as it is for the Dominican audiences, because it feels so familiar and so real to them.
The central character in the film, Miguel, this young pitcher, is finally invited to go from the Dominican Republic to the spring training camp of a major league team, the one whose academy he was attending. And it's an immigrant journey, of course. And there are these classic, you know, images we know of an immigrant's journey to America, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island. I mean, clearly, these were a different set of images. Tell us a little bit about how you wanted to depict his experience of coming to America.
Well, you know, it's interesting because here's a guy, he's from a very small town, and when he comes to the United States, he comes to another very small town. He's not coming to the Statue of Liberty in New York City and finding community there and people who, you know, in New York, you know, there's so many neighborhoods where you can really, no matter where you're from, you can find people who speak your language. He comes to a small town in Iowa where most people are white and very few people speak Spanish, and he has to interact with these folks. And so I think that was what was unique about this immigrant journey for us and what we wanted to explore.
It is true, though, that before he goes to Iowa, he does come through Arizona. And there was something interesting. And when he's in Arizona, he's with a bunch of his friends who we saw him with in the Dominican Republic, who are also stepping up to the next level with him. And Arizona does have a large, you know, Mexican, Spanish-speaking community there. And so it was kind of like a nice way to ease into American culture in a way. At least there was something familiar. He had a group of friends to go out with, and they were all trying to order food together for the first time. And then it's almost as if, as he then moves on to the next level in Iowa, things that are familiar to him are kind of slowly stripped away, and he's becoming more and more isolated as he goes.
And there's a clip I want to play from the film that really, I think, captures some of this, his experience in confronting a world that's totally different. And that is when he is at the home of the couple that's going to host him. This is Anne and Earl Higgins, an elderly farm couple who are big boosters of the minor league team that he is assigned to, the Bridgetown Swing, they're called. And I thought we'd play this cut where they are taking him around and acquainting him with the house.
This is your new quarto bedroom. You do with it as you please, except no girls. Chicas. No chicas.
No drinking. No cervezas in the casa. No chicas in the bedroom.
I already told him that one.
Okay. What about quiet time?
Oh, right. There's no real curfew, but you must be quiet after 10.
Dias. Shh. After Dias. Huh?
Ding. Okay.
See? And that's all we ask. It's our job to keep you healthy and focused on baseball.
And we take pride in that.
And that's a scene from Sugar, which is written and directed by my guests, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. It's just such a wonderful scene. I don't want to tell too much of the story here. I mean, we're really, one of the things we're fascinated with as we watch it develop is how far Miguel's going to get and whether he's going to make it in the big leagues. But it's clear that when he first has to take the mound in the United States, even in a minor league game, it's a different world. He was a guy who told his friends there's nobody better. Just tell us a little bit about how you wanted to tell that story of him facing a whole different kind of pressure and competition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the competition is so fierce in professional sports. It's really, the odds of making it and succeeding are so small. And for these guys who are playing down in the Dominican Republic, and there's so much riding on their success to pull their families out of poverty, and there's all these pressures, and then, you know, they may be playing really well on that level, but when they have to come over and compete with a whole new level of competition and have those pressures on their shoulders, I think it's a lot to ask of any young athlete.
And he's performing in front of a crowd of people for the first time, you know, in the Dominican Republic and the minor league games at spring training. More often than not, there are very few, if any, people watching you. And to be on that mound for the first time and have, you know, an opening night crowd all around you and, you know, every time you throw a ball, people are making upset noises. I think that really, and he sees the Higgins, his host family, watching him in from the stands. The pressure really mounts, and we wonder whether he's going to be able to pull through that first game.
Well, you know, it's not telling people too much to say that when he first takes the mound, he's clearly nervous, and he walks the first batter on 4 pitches. Pitches are high, which is often what happens when a pitcher is nervous and overthrows. And then the catcher comes out, or was it an infielder, and speaks to him in Spanish, right?
Yeah, his third baseman, his Dominican friend.
And says what?
He says, calm down. You know, it's the same game we played back home, you know, and I think for some reason that has a big effect on him. You know, it's just the same game, you know, and these guys. And then there's another Dominican player that comes up to bat next, and it just feels instantly familiar to him again.
You know, there's one other moment at which he goes through a tough stretch, and as eating at the table of the Higgins, his farm family that are hosting him in this minor league team, and he apologizes and weeps and is embraced by by Mr. Higgins. It's just such a great little moment. You want to talk a little bit about that scene?
Yeah, that scene, you know, is really powerful, and it was powerful to shoot too, and difficult for Al Henness. I think he was nervous coming into that scene because he really has to make himself vulnerable as an actor.
And he's not an actor. Let's remind the audience.
And
that's right.
He's not an actor. No, but he really pulls it off, and I think, you know, he takes there's a towards that end of the second act in the movie, he takes a pretty drastic step before one of the games, and he really has kind of a meltdown. And he feels like not only has he let himself down and let his family down back home, but I think he's in a lot of pain, and he feels like he's let down this family that's been really kind to him up until this moment. And I think that the Higgins as well, they see a really vulnerable boy in front of them for the first time, and is not just an athlete there to make their team good, but he's a human being with feelings.
You know, after you made the film, this spring a scandal erupted over the alleged skimming of signing bonuses from young Dominican players, and it's most affected the Washington Nationals, where the general manager has resigned. This, I guess, particularly involved the signing of a young prospect who was signed under a false identity with the wrong age, making him appear to be younger than he really was. And even Jose Rijo, who was in the Nationals front office and who I believe was a consultant and appeared in your film, was fired. Were you surprised when this scandal erupted? How did it affect you?
Well, you know, we were definitely surprised that Jose Rijo ended up being so involved and that he lost his job. You know, he was a very good consultant, and we really enjoyed working with him. On the other hand, having a false identity and making it seem like you're younger than you actually are, and, you know, people taking advantage of these young players who are in poverty is nothing new in the Dominican Republic and has been happening for quite a while, and everybody's been aware of it all the way up the line. I think that I'm not sure exactly why this particular case got so much attention, but, you know, I think that most people that are working down there and that are working with these young players are, you know, well-intentioned, good people, and, you know, more often than not, everybody's on the level. But it's a place that's been fairly unregulated for a long time and is just starting to be more regulated and looked at. And this stuff has been happening.
Yeah, I think the players are being signed for more and more money now. You know, in the early days, I believe Sammy Sosa and Jose Rijo himself, they were signed for about $2,000 in the 80s. And now I think this kid involved with this scandal is, you know, it was $1.5 million, $2 million. I think now they're starting to be scrutinized a lot more that now that there's more money involved.
Right, with that kind of money, there's certainly more temptation for mischief. I wanted to talk a little bit about your film from 2006, Half Nelson, which just got great reviews and a lot of awards. And it's the story of this idealistic, politically conscious young white man who's teaching in a public school in an inner city public school with mostly black students, and takes an interest, develops a friendship with a girl who I guess is 13. He also coaches her in basketball. And one of the things that develops is that he is concerned that she may be falling under the influence of a neighborhood drug dealer, who is a guy who had a relationship with her brother. But of course, the truth is that he himself is struggling with a serious cocaine problem, which extends to smoking crack. And I thought we'd listen to a scene here, and this is a scene in which Dan Dunn, this teacher who is played by Ryan Gosling, decides he has to go and confront this drug dealer and get him out of this kid's life. The drug dealer is played by Anthony Mackie. Let's listen.
Can I talk to you?
What's up?
Okay, look. I hate to be this guy right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I need you to stay away from Dre.
Excuse me?
You heard me, okay? So just do me this solid, all right, man? Please.
Do you solid?
You know what I'm saying. You understand.
Oh, so this, like, stay away from the girl, she's too precious kind of
I'm not kidding.
Oh, I know.
So you understand?
Look, man, Dre is my family. She's my friend, man. All these cats, these are my friends. And would you like to be my friend, man?
What the is this? Romper room?
What is the romper room?
Are you listening to me?
Why are you so angry, man?
Because you are not listening.
Look,
to
right
me.
I'm right here, baby. Tell me what you're talking
I'm
about.
I'm telling you to do something good.
Oh.
Are you capable of that?
Oh. So now we're back to the point of what is white is right, right?
So this has nothing to do with
no,
that.
No, no, no. It's good for Dre to have somebody like you looking out for him. Mr. Model A1 citizen.
I don't know.
And that's a scene from the film Half Nelson, written and directed by our guest Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. I just love that confrontation, and it's just so fascinating that we have this white middle-class teacher here wanting to protect the kid from the drug dealer. And, in fact, it's the drug dealer who has his life much more together. It's sort of, you know. One of the things that I liked about the film is that, you know, there are plot elements here that are familiar to a lot of things. You know, the kid of the single parent struggling in a world of poverty and crime and then the heist, you know, the teacher who develops a relationship and an interest. But these characters aren't simple, and it would have been so easy to just push things a little too far in the characterization or the plot developments. I was talk a little about some of the choices you made in that way.
I think that the process of writing this movie was in a lot of ways stripping away the things that those things around what you might imagine the movie to be that aren't really what the movie is about. And I think what you're talking about, like the overriding characters or making them too stereotypical, that was something that, you know, I don't think was necessarily part of the first draft, but I think elements of that were, and kind of rewriting it was stripping those elements away and getting at the humanity of everybody in the movie.
The visual style is interesting. I mean, there's a lot of documentary, like, kind of, were they handheld cameras? I mean, it had sort of a documentary feel at moments.
And Half Nelson, yeah, sure. I mean, it was all handheld. There's a couple sequences that we used a tripod for, but we very rarely brought out that tripod from the truck, and it was a big deal when the word would come down that the Grips had to bring that tripod out because they didn't know where it was.
Well, is that because you wanted to give it a documentary feel, like you're really the intimacy of it?
Sure. We studied a lot of Frederick Wiseman documentaries, you know, very observant, always handheld. When the camera sort of lingers on characters for a while, uncomfortably long sometimes. When you want to get away from them, you get closer and you stay on them longer. And that was kind of the vibe we were going for.
You know, you're a couple, right? And met you were both in film school in New York, is that right?
Yeah, we were in film school. I was at NYU and it was at Columbia, and we met on a student film there that we helped each other out on.
Yeah, well, let me ask the ridiculously trite question of what it's like to have your personal and professional lives so welded. I mean, I can imagine that it's great because you share each other's passions, but you kind of also maybe you never get away from each other and never get away from your projects.
Yeah, that's true. We spend a lot of time, going out to dinner and ending up talking about our work or whatever. But it's also really nice, I think, particularly in a business where you have so many collaborators and so many people with different opinions about what you ought to be doing, to have that one person who you trust entirely and who you know that their intentions and your intentions are exactly the same, and to kind of fortify you with all of the other, you know, opinions and thoughts coming at you.
You know, I noticed that in Half Nelson, Ryan, you had the directing credit, and in Sugar, that it's co-directed. Do you guys have defined roles? Do you feel like you need to define them, or are you both just collaborating on everything?
You know, we work together on all aspects, and even on Half Nelson, even though I was credited as the director, Anna was there on set every day. We wrote it together, and she cut the film. And I think we were still kind of feeling out how we were going to work together, and we thought, you know, I had kind of a fiction film background, even if it was short films, and Anna hadn't worked that way before, so it just kind of was the logical roles. And we didn't want to confuse the actors by we weren't sure how we were going to work together as co-directors yet. But on this movie, it really made sense. You know, Anna's Spanish is way better than mine. And
we were working with somebody who had never acted before. And one of the really great things about working with non-actors is they have no expectations of what things should be like. And people often ask Hannes, oh, what was it like working with two directors? He's like, I don't know what's it like working with one director. You know, it's his only experience. And we didn't come into this movie as concerned that, you know, actors would have expectations about having only one person talk to them, or, you know, everybody was so open and willing to work in a new way. And that was a really nice way to start this process of co-directing, which we might continue in the future.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to more great stuff from you. Ryan Fleck, Anna Boden, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, they wrote and directed the new film Sugar.